Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
You're listening to a Snipper Nixon production. Welcome to Are You Feeling Funny, where top comedians discuss health and well-being with Harley Street specialist and our host, Dr. Brian Kaplan. Today's guest is Adam Kay, so let's join them in the heart of Harley Street.
Welcome to Are You Feeling Funny, Adam Kay.
Thanks for having me, Doctor.
Okay, so you are first doctor on the program that we've had, and this program is about your experiences as a patient and coming to contact with the medical profession and what it was like. And I'm an old-fashioned holistic doctor, so I like to look at things physical, then mental, then spiritual, body, mind, and spirit. So let's start off with just anything to do with physical medicine, any interactions you've had with A&E or doctors, but to do with the physical side of medicine.
I think you'd agree that doctors make quite bad patients.
Notoriously so, yes.
I think most people are quite bad patients. They either see doctors too much or too little, and doctors definitely see other doctors too little.
Mm-hmm.
And so I only really see a doctor when there's something obviously the matter. Most recently, when I broke my ankle.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, I probably can't sort this out on my own. So I think that was my most recent significant interaction with.
How'd you do that?
With the professor.
So that's the story of it.
Oh, I wish it was something really exciting and involved some sort of fleeing from a gunfight or skiing. But no, the book had just come out in hardback last September, and I'd done some telly thing with Sky and was just sort of peeling myself out of the taxi and slipped on some wet foliage outside my house and sort of just mm-hmm. plumped onto the ground and couldn't get up, which I remembered is a bad sign. And I couldn't get up to the extent that I had to. Oh, and I destroyed my phone during the process of this.
Oh, yeah.
So I couldn't even, I needed to attract attention. Our street's very quiet and there was no one around. So I was just sort of yelling to my partner from outside the house to be rescued. And so he sort of ignored that for about 10 minutes, then eventually wondered what the noise was and came and found me, scooped me up. And I was lying on the sofa going, oh, it'll be fine, it's just a bit swollen. By this point, it's the size of a sort of watermelon. And then eventually I conceded that
need
an x-ray.
It's interesting that you talk about that interaction between yourself and the patients. I mean, in your book, I know there's some horrific stories there. They're like stories from the trenches in the First World War that Robert Graves and Eric von Remarque would be too embarrassed to tell. Some of the stories are really graphic. Are there interactions with you in any other instances with physical medicine, or you've been lucky with your health? Or?
I'm reasonably clumsy,
mm-hmm.
and when I fall down, I do it really properly.
Oh, yes.
So I've over the years I've done two wrists, one elbow, three ankles. I mean that's been most of it.
So you're not dyspraxic as such, though. Because I'm sure I am undiagnosed. My son was diagnosed, and because he was diagnosed, he was given so many privileges and allowed to type instead of write and all sorts of things at university.
Well, I think I've got decent motor coordination.
Uh-huh.
I mean, I can play the piano to a sort of all right level. And but I think the diagnosis is klutz. I'm just sort of, don't look where I'm going. Yeah. Just sort of fall off.
Should we look it up in Kumar and Clark?
Yeah.
Klutzism.
Yeah, so I think I've got a sort of end-stage Klutzism. That's the main thing. And I think I'm very lucky that I haven't had to bother the profession too much. I had I've only had one operation, which was to take out a disc.
Oh, you had that? That's fairly, back surgery is no joke, huh?
I was on holiday, and it was another not being able to walk moment when my right leg kind of just stopped working. And I also remembered that wasn't right from...
You had some nerve compression from this disc.
As it turned out. And so I ignored it until... I couldn't completely ignore it because I had to be in a wheelchair. And my husband isn't a doctor and sort of he comes to me for like medical things. Is this fine? Should I worry about this? You know, and so when I told him in no uncertain terms, this is fine, I just need to be in a wheelchair for a bit until we get home. It was like, okay. So I went along with it. And then straight off the plane back home a few days later, I saw a neurosurgeon who sort of imaged my spine and told me off for waiting this length of time with a sort of motor injury to my to my leg. But ultimately, all's well that ends well. They took out a disc. I've got the scar to show. I've also got the disc in some formalin.
Oh, wonderful!
In my office, like a sort of low rent an anatomical museum.
Did they do a fusion of vertebra then in your case?
No, they just whipped it out.
And it's okay. You're not in pain, or you?
I'm all right. All right. Mustn't grumble.
Yeah, okay. So anything else? Any other physical stuff that you've had? Any diseases or infections?
Diseases and infections. I mean, I get tonsillitis.
You're prone to it, yeah?
Prone to it. Don't know why. In fact, the last time I had it was a few years ago, and I was out working in the States again. And I knew I had tonsillitis. And because I'd had it before, I sort of shone the phone torch in the mirror and sort of like, oh, got that again. And was basically phoning round to see if a doctor would be prepared to just write me a prescription for some antibiotics. I know what normally works for me. And the cheapest I could get seen and prescribed was hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of dollars for a 1 second consultation and a prescription. And I always remember that when the conversation about NHS funding come up, that could well be the ghost of Christmas future.
Ruthless capitalist medicine. I mean, in America, I was shocked to read someone told me the price of a Ventolin inhaler in America, something like $75 for one inhaler. Works.
That's insane.
Do you know America? There's an article that I read in the New England Journal of Medicine in the 90s. 2010, New England Journal of Medicine, January edition, I think it is, that gives a rating for what health services are provided by a country relative to other countries for all its citizens.
Okay.
We know that America supplies the best medicine money can buy, but not the best medicine money can't, that they do without money,
yes.
Right?
Yes.
America is listed 37th in the world. In the quality of medicine supplied to all the people. So we know all the magical stuff and dissecting the genome and all that, that's American. But just in basic services, 37th in the world. We're quite high up, 7th. I think France was top of the list.
In America, there's no gatekeeper.
Yeah.
If you want to see, if you've suddenly decided that you've got something wrong with your spleen for no other reason than you sort of, it came to you in a vision, you can go and see, the world's best spleenologist, but there's no gatekeeper. There's no one stopping you doing it. People, in my opinion, don't go to medical school because they want money.
No, I agree.
You'd be mad
nuts
to go to. You have to have all of these A-levels, all of these extracurricular whatnots. It's a very inefficient. You might as well play the lottery if you think that's going to make you a wealthy person.
Completely agree.
if you're in America, I'm not so sure. Because that was the lie the government told when the doctors were striking, or they're being greedy, they're in it for the money, which wasn't the case.
They went on strike because a new contract was going to affect working conditions, which means patient safety, which means the best interest of the patient. The best interest of the patient is the only thing that doctors care about, and that's why they do the job.
Hi there, sorry. I know I'm definitely not as interesting, but just 2 seconds of your time. We're the company that make this show, Snipper Nixon. We do podcasts, we develop scripts, and much more. If you want to know more about us, find us at snippernixon.com. Oh, and if you are enjoying the show, please comment, tell a friend, subscribe, or send a carrier pigeon. We'll be back after these messages.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Now, back to Harley Street with Dr. Brian Kaplan and Adam Kay.
Okay, let's move on to body, from body to mind. Have you had any, and when I say mind, I don't mean only psychoanalysis and psychotherapy. I mean motivational coaches, seminars, group work, anything like that. Any experience in that field, especially if it's something funny?
I think I've done my own therapy.
Yeah, tell me.
My book tells the story of all my time as a doctor and how I eventually left.
Yes.
And when I left, it's because I didn't have the emotional wherewithal, the force field to deal with if you're on labour ward and the worst happens. I couldn't deal with it.
Just to elaborate, I think what you're talking about is one of the worst things that can happen. I've done obstetrics and gynecology too, and I'm not specialized, but I experienced and I delivered 30 babies, etc. But you describe the worst nightmare of anything, losing. Yeah.
So you all you want from any patient, whether the birth plan goes to plan or not, you want healthy mum, healthy baby.
Yeah.
And this was one of the extremely rare scenarios where you end up with neither.
Mm. Neither alive.
I don't go into too much detail about the exact outcomes in the book to protect the family involved, so it doesn't become too recognizable.
Mm.
But yeah, it was basically the worst that could happen.
Mm.
No one suggested it was my fault. No one suggested anyone could have done anything differently. And in fact, it's just one of these things. Shit happens.
Mm.
And basically, I was told that every 5 or 6 years, if you're the most senior obstetrician on the ward, I was the senior registrar, and it was out of hours, it was a weekend, so I was the most senior person there. It happens every 5 or 6 years.
Something like that, the exact incident, yeah.
Some major disaster. And I realised that whilst I could probably see myself getting through this one, I would just be watching the clock until the next one, and I couldn't face that being my career. And so I left medicine and I didn't talk about medicine. And I worked as a comedy writer, and people would say, oh, you used to be a doctor. Why didn't you, are you interested in working up something involving a hospital? I was like, nope. And I never told anyone the reason that I left. And you'll appreciate that's not the most healthy approach to things. But I just couldn't talk about it. It was too upsetting. So my parents knew I'd left medicine, obviously, but didn't know why I'd left medicine until they read a copy of my book last September, you know, years and years and years after the event. My partner didn't know why I'd left medicine until I was up in the Edinburgh Fringe reading out from my diaries.
Mm-hmm.
The reason that, and it feels bizarre saying this now, because it's been, you know, they've cut down loads of trees and printed hundreds of thousands of copies of this book, and I go around the country talking about it. But just at the time, I just couldn't face thinking about it, talking about it. And the thing that changed was the junior doctor strike. I suddenly realised it doesn't matter if it's healthy for me. It's not healthy for the public. The public need to know mm-hmm. what doctors and nurses and physios and paramedics and all these healthcare professionals actually do. The healthcare profession should be shouting out about the reality of the work so that next time a government says, oh, doctors are just being greedy, they're in it for money, the public can say, that's ridiculous. Absolute nonsense. Why would anyone in their right mind do that job for anything other than the right reasons? And I realised that I potentially was in a powerful position
mm-hmm.
to amplify the doctor's voice. The doctor's voice is so quiet. I mean, they have their trade union representatives and whatever, but the actual voice of real junior doctors who know what it's like on the coalface is very quiet.
I agree with you. I mean, just when you hear a minister say doctors are greedy on the NHS, you can just feel total solidarity with every other doctor in the country knowing that he's talking complete yes. garbage. You know?
However, the government won that war at
yeah.
the time
yeah.
because we can only respond to the data we're given. Doesn't matter what colour political tie we wear or whatever we think of the NHS, if we're told some stuff, we respond to that data. And doctors are at work 100 hours a week. How can they? So I thought if I could, you know, if I could spread that message, then it would be worth, you know, the thing that I really didn't want to do, which I did do, was talking about my the bad stuff and the sad stuff that happened to me. But what I realised was the more I talked about it, the less I minded talking about it.
This became the therapy for you.
I did my own therapy.
Yes.
And in a very unconventional way, you know, standing up in front of hundreds or thousands of people at a time and, you know, reading out that particular diary entry and other ones and talking about it. And I wonder if what I had was some degree of PTSD because probably not technically, but it must be something allied to that because it would be a frequent thing I dreamed about, and
yes.
I would have sort of little flashbacks, and I would sort of wake up in a panic, and it would be that again, and that's not happened.
Do you know there's this thing called EMDR? I don't know if you've heard about it, where you get a patient to move their eyes. You tell
yes,
them what your finger
yes, yeah.
And the whole purpose of that is that the idea is that when we dream, we let go of stuff that is unconsciously upsetting us. So they just get the person to think about a traumatic event and then their eyes move
yeah.
as in rapid eye,
yeah.
either following
yeah.
a finger or following a light.
Yeah.
And this actually allows stuff to be released. So what you're saying, if stuff is emerging in dreams, it
yeah.
shows that you hadn't processed everything that you needed to.
Yeah, no, that's very interesting. It's not something I know anything about really, this side of things. But what I do know is now it's a demon I don't.
Do you think that, so the therapy was performing or writing or both, would you say?
The therapy, because the writing had already happened.
Mm-hmm. When did you write? Let's just clarify
so
that.
So these were contemporaneous yeah. diaries that I kept at the time.
And all those funny, ironic remarks that you make, did you write those down or did you come back and sort of look at it again? Or because that's very funny. It usually ended ironically. Yeah.
I tried to be as honest as possible without going to prison. So obviously patient details had to change. The publishers were extremely keen that, particularly them, but also me, didn't go to prison. And so obviously the clinical details changed and personal details, so people couldn't recognise themselves. And the other thing is, you know, the bulk of the diaries were very boring because it was just, you know, did cesarean section number 412 or something. No one wants to read that. But the main thing I wanted to achieve with the book is to have a fair reflection of what it is to be a junior doctor. I wanted my colleagues to say, mum, read this. This is what
fantastic.
It's like.
Yeah.
And that meant sort of choosing the balance between the funny and the sad and the revolting and the high octane and the petty bureaucracies and the impact it has on your life. All those things I wanted. I felt like I was a sound desk sort of with all these different levels trying to get it right. And so that's something else I fiddled with in diary. A lot of the entries were just scribbled down on post-it notes or were just a few bullet points of the thing.
Did you just put them all in a box or what did you do? You came home from a shift exhausted and wrote notes, yes?
I generally wrote them on the shift.
Unbelievable. So, you know, you see, one of the greatest, most acclaimed biographies, although it's not an actual biography, is Boswell's Life of Samuel Johnson. Now, what is remarkable about it is also a set of diary entries. There's about 370 fine print pages of really diary entries, but some of them can go on for a few pages. But what Boswell would talk to Johnson till 2 o'clock in the morning or 11 o'clock at night or whatever it was, but he'd come home at the early hours of the morning and write it down. You see, I was reading your book and I'm thinking, you know, every doctor's had a journey like this. It's not only him. It's particularly dramatic in obstetrics, but we all relate.
Every doctor
to this.
Could
every
write doctor. The book.
And that's what I was thinking. I could have written this book, but yes. You wrote it. You see, well, brilliant. Yeah.
No, I've not come up with the genre of medical memoir. There are shelves and shelves and shelves on any bookshop where you can read those. But I wanted to do I wanted to tell my story. And it's interesting when I speak to non-medics about it, they'll say, oh, that story, did that really happen?
Yeah.
Doctors never say that. Doctors say, that's nothing. Here's my top story. 10 revolting exactly. stories. Because, yeah, every doctor could have told the story.
I wouldn't say it's nothing, but I can also have a... If I thought about writing about things in my memory, there are incidents like that, exactly.
And I now realise that the reason I was writing these funny diary entries... Mm-hmm. was a form of therapy at the time.
Yes,
it was my pressure release valve. It was looking for the shards of light amongst the dark.
Yeah. And you did it there and then on the shift, you see. You picked up a pencil and you did it. You did the therapy. That's the key. A lot of people could think these things, but writing them down is another
there's
thing.
I don't want to name the hospital because then, prison. But there's there was one bench on a labour ward in the male changing rooms. Yeah. And I the number of hours I must have sat there at the end of a shift. I had my little position and my just write a few things down. I'm very glad I did. At the time, I just thought, what did I think I was doing? I guess I felt I'd always enjoyed writing. I was always the class clown. I'd always liked comedy, but And then, but I chose the medical route. I chose I didn't choose humanities. And so this allowed me to do it. And I sort of, I'd obviously read all of Alan Bennett and I was obsessed with David Sedaris. I just wanted to, knowing that I wasn't anyway as good as them, but it's sort of, I could use my turns of phrase that appealed to me and jot them down. But I never thought they would get, I never thought, oh, there's a book in this. But no one is saying... You know, it can be a bit tough. Yeah. They don't tell you when you're applying and they don't tell you during medical school. And then once you're a doctor, it's very much the approach of, we're bloody doctors and we'll bloody get on with it and a stiff upper lip and a stiff drink and, never talk about anything.
Shut the F up.
Yes, exactly. And just sort of, you don't want to be... It's the idea of a doctor not being a human.
Yeah, 100%.
And I talk about this a bit in the book, the... idea that the person who you're going to interpret the MRI of your brain and then tell you what the management is, you need them to be 100% correct. You don't want to think this is a person who makes mistakes. And so you act the role a bit.
Yeah.
And so then you think of yourself, even subconsciously, as this sort of superhuman. But the flip side of that is that superhumans don't get sick. And they don't get sad.
Yeah, but you're meant to be like that.
We're allowed to make mistakes.
Well, it's funny you talk about medical students because I was about a third of the way through your book, and I'm mentoring a medical someone who's interested in becoming a medical student, and she said she's not sure she wanted to do medicine. So I said, read this book, and then I read a few horrific stories in your book, and then I phoned her and said, no, don't read anything unless you know you want to do medicine. Then you must read this book.
I would say. Medicine is a job to go into with both your eyes wide open.
Yes.
So it has these impacts on your life, sort of those practical ones, and also the emotional side of it. And so if we're being honest that medicine has bad hours, we can also be honest that it has other bad aspects.
But you also, I will say to you that you did in the book also talk about the exhilaration of feeling useful and coming back late from a shift and knowing that you've done some good in the world. You do mention yeah. the highs as
the
well.
The highs. Yeah. But I worked in OBS and gynae. You end up with twice the number of patients you start with, which is, you know, no other branch of medicine can say that. But the problem with the specialty is the height of the highs is set off by the depth of the lows. So I think you can see every branch of medicine as a sine wave. So, and the higher the highs, it's a mirror image, the lower lows. I suspect I would still be a doctor if I'd have chosen a flatter sine wave. And there is always, you can always kill a patient. So even if, you know, you're a dermatologist and, you know, you think that is the, you know, the very opposite, derma holiday, we used to call it at medical school. If you say that, you know, that's just a mole, go home, and it turns out it was a basal
cell
cancer.
Someone said to me, a doctor once said to me that I've known for 30 years, he said, you know, he almost believes that medicine is a club, that you only really become a member of that club when there's an incident which just haunts you and that you could have done different, you could have done a bit better yourself, when you actually look back and think, oh, I said the wrong thing or I did the wrong thing.
Sure.
Yeah, and we all have that.
We've all got those. Yeah. But why not preempt that by teaching people how best to deal with it?
Yeah, you don't get that. Thanks for talking about all of that. And I'm very fascinated that your therapy was this speaking it out, sharing and doing something with it and influencing people. Let's move on to spiritual health. So let me ask you the basic question first that I ask everyone. Do you believe in God?
I don't believe in God.
And do you have any experience of spiritual or religious experiences or interaction with religious people or anything you'd like to?
Into some weddings? Does that? I was brought up in a not particularly frum Jewish household.
Frum means orthodox and following all the rules, yeah.
So, in as much as, you know, they would go to shul, to synagogue a couple of times a year, and they would keep kosher, but...
I keep kosher, pretty much.
Semi-kosher. Apart from prawns. They wouldn't eat pig.
Yeah,
that was their sort of... That was
eat
their
prawns
version.
In a restaurant, but not at home, sort of.
Oh, no, they'd eat them at home as well. Actually, they just didn't eat pig.
It's slightly less than kosher.
That's modified kosher.
Yeah, okay.
But that was the... Like, we did Christmas.
Yes.
That was the most
Christmas
important...
Christmas tree. Yeah.
Christmas tree, Christmas presents. That was, you know... I don't think the chief rabbi would put them on the front page of the Jewish Chronicle or whatever as model Jewish citizens. So that was the environment I grew up in. I had a bar mitzvah when I was 13.
Yep.
And then I just didn't, it wasn't for me.
You weren't inspired by any rabbinical sermons or, yeah.
I wasn't, just didn't work for me.
And anything else like meditation or anything that qualifies as sort of, tree hugging, anything like that?
No, I think I've always, and I suspect it's going straight into medicine at age, 18 and that very scientific approach, and then choosing a specialty, which as you say, is part surgical, who are presumably the least spiritual of all the possible branches of medicine. I was always fairly cynical about that. And I think it's more than possible to be a good person without having a religion.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's possible to be together and have a calm life without going to yoga.
Do you think that obstetrics potentially is spiritual in a sense? You know, I read when I was doing obstetrics in fourth year medicine and it was in Africa and in Soweto, and I had a child. I remember delivering 9 babies in one night. That's something. That's
Goodness,
quite something.
Yeah.
Because it's as a ward of, you know, a massive ward with about 25 booths on either side. And once I was walking past that night, I was walking past a booth and I just saw baby's head appearing without any attendants there. So I went into this, but this could happen. So I went into this room and the nurse, and I said, where's the gloves? And no, there's no time for gloves. Just deliver this baby. Just do it. And I had this experience of delivering this baby with the bare hands without any, and I never forgot that. Everything was fine. But I also have a horrible memory of a doctor running across the ward to do a shoulder presentation and not making. And there you see the woman recovering from a major operation, having lost her baby. Really hard. But it did. Girlfriend at the time said to me, read this book by Frederick Leboyer called Birth Without Violence. And there I eventually met the man, and he was spiritual. He was sort of had a spiritual feel, how we treat the young. His view was that the baby is not a thing. It is a human being with all the senses and feelings, not verbal, but feeling everything, feeling the anxiety in the room and everything. So there's some magic in obstetrics, and it comes across in your book too.
Yeah, there is magic. It's an amazing, it's an amazing, amazing thing. But I suspect I was on the practical end of things rather than the soppy end of things, and it's a magical time, I think, for the family. When you've done 2,000 of the bloody things, it's sort of the magic wears off a little.
Yeah, and you just want to be technically good. So have your family forgiven you for leaving medicine now? Have they moved towards forgiveness? Or?
Yeah, I think, yeah. Ish. I suspect, and maybe this is partly a cultural thing, and partly it's just your brainstem, human nature is you want your kids to be all right. And for them, leaving this sensible job where you got a monthly, paycheck, and it was a job for life, and it was well respected, and my son the doctor, and I left that, and they were. I don't think they still quite understand how I make ends meet. Don't quite understand what being a comedy writer for television actually.
They must know what a best-selling non-fiction writer is, though.
And I think that's sort of more on their terms, because it's sort of the Sunday Times prints it every week, so they can. I think they're no longer worried for me, which potentially initially they was manifest in other emotions.
And they might see that you're happier, less stressed, or
I'm
not less stressed.
I mean, I'm less fulfilled.
yeah.
Because nothing, the arts are important, of course, but you can't convince yourself you're doing as good a thing, by making people laugh on a sitcom as actually, delivering their baby safely in the middle of the night. So I don't have that fulfillment I had, but what I do have is a work-life balance, and I choose the work I do. And before, my work-life balance was 100-0. I didn't have a life particularly. Work was my life. It becomes, there isn't time for anything else. So now, as a result of that, I am much happier. Overall, my net vector is towards happiness.
Do you think that, that's lovely to hear, do you think that there's, when you on stage and you say something and there's a good response to it, do you feel there's a type of healing in that when everyone laughs at something together? If it's,
I think I'm slightly immune to that. I think initially the buzz of the crowd, because if in medicine, if you do a great cesarean, no one stands up and claps. Mm. And, in fact, the only feedback you ever get in medicine is when you fuck up, or a scene to.
Or if you're slow.
So if anyone's got a criticism, you'll be called into an office and you'll be told off and you'll have your wrist slapped. But no, it's very rare that, and that's why I kept every thank you card I got from a patient, and they've survived. How many house moves I made over the years. I never will. And when I turned in my GMC badge and gun and said I'm no longer on the register, I threw away a huge amount of stuff. But I'm never going to throw those away. So, but obviously, it's basic human psychology, isn't it? We like being told we're great,
we're useful.
And on stage, a bunch of people, round of applause from a room of. Whether it's 5, 10, 1,000, 10,000, great. That's a real, dopamine fist bump, isn't it?
But I'm thinking more of when they laugh. Do you feel the release of something? I don't know if you...
I did. No, I think more. I've now proved to myself that's something I can, do. And it's not an arrogance about it, just that I'm just experience. I'd like to think, and having said this now, my next gig is going to be a disaster. I've now done this enough that...
I assume people are going to laugh and it's going to be nice and they're going to have a nice evening, blah, blah, blah. But no longer do I come off stage and think, oh, great, yes. Ah. Now it's sort of, I've done my day at work.
But you're different because other comedians have said that they're so adrenalized after doing a gig, they've got to drink wine and eat nuts and hang in there. It's not easy for them. Yeah, maybe your time in theater and the stuff like that has made you into a different type of comedian.
Oh, yeah, maybe my barometer has set to a lower level. And also I do other things, so it's not the thing I enjoy most, getting up on stage. I'd sort of stopped doing that for a couple of years.
Do you enjoy most then?
I enjoy, work-wise, not writing, which I hate. I enjoy having written. And I enjoy the germ of the idea. I'm like, oh, wow, this could be a great thing. And then I love the bit at the end, like, oh, look at this thing. I mean, those are my two favourite things. Oh, yeah, that bit in the middle, it's just a nightmare. But I can't find a way around that bit. Yeah. I get huge pleasure from...
You're a wordsmith and a craftsman. I mean, lovely writing in your book.
Oh, that's kind of you.
Let me ask you a couple of things, like, do you have any health regimen that you do that you actually stick to or anything like that? Or
No, not really. I'm a bit of a sort of, I'm probably a physical wreck, aren't I? Mm-hmm. I don't smoke. Uh-huh. That's something. I don't drink the most out of everyone. I don't do any drugs. Uh-huh. So, I mean, those are some good things. I don't exercise, which I guess...
it's going to be a list of don'ts here.
Yes, I don't. Exactly. I'm vegetarian.
Oh, there you go.
So, okay. I mean, that's something. But with most vegetarians, it's mostly bread and cheese and pasta and pizza, isn't it?
I nearly killed myself being vegetarian in a ward, eating hospital canteen food, you know?
Oh, yeah. You die of starvation if you're sort of... If my body is a temple, it's one of these sort of ruined Damascan ones.
Okay, last thing. Is there any tip that you'd give people to be happy or healthy or anything? Any one tip that you could suggest?
I was thinking about this before because someone asked me, you know, what would you tell your 16-year-old self in an interview?
Yes.
I couldn't really think of anything at the time, but then I sort of left and then spent an evening thinking about it. I think it sort of applies to everyone, that no one, stop worrying what people think about you,
mm-hmm.
because they're probably not thinking that. No one really cares
probably not even thinking about you at all, is 100% right. I've heard that encapsulated in the saying, what other people think about you is an event in their lives, not in your life.
Oh, that's lovely. Yeah, no, that tells it much better, doesn't it? I used to be sort of very conscious about, you know, dressing right and, you know, being seen at the right parties. And then suddenly I had an epiphany. I don't need to pretend to be cool. I don't need to pretend to be something I'm not.
Yeah, you come here with a short-sleeved shirt and sandals, you know.
I'm looking like a nightmare, aren't I?
I expect people to be hosed down and come in a suit to Harley Street.
So, yeah, and I'm really bringing down the tone of the neighbourhood, aren't I?
It's delightful, actually.
I think that's quite important. And I think I became happier when I realised that. Also, you don't need to choose what you want to do forever mm-hmm. when you're sort of filling out your UCAS form.
Yeah.
I think we can have interesting careers. I think two generations back, it would be unheard of to do anything other than go into one trade when you left school or university and stay there until you got your carriage clock when you were 65, 70.
Mm-hmm.
You know, now you're allowed to, I mean, the horrible LA term is you're allowed to pivot careers.
Oh, no, I'm doing the expression, yeah.
Okay, so you can pivot whenever you like, and it might, you know, don't do something you don't
enjoy.
Maybe
you'll pivot back into medicine one day.
You know what? I think I probably won't do any caesareans anymore. But I've got a huge amount of personal satisfaction, and I've seen myself being useful again through talking to medical students and young doctors about the concept of caring for the care and looking after yourself. And I wonder if I might find for myself some role in medical education, be it that or be it even just, you know, teaching medical students
ops and gynae. People reading this book, it's serving a role, and people are obviously responding to it.
But for me, it was getting a message across, and I'm absolutely humbled and astonished and so grateful to all the team at the publishers and their, you know, writing, being the person who writes the book, it's like being the male partner in producing a child. It's, you know, it's a few minutes work 9 months earlier and then nothing. Then it's you sort of completely hand over responsibility to someone
else. Yeah, I'm aware of that. Yeah, because I'm like, I talk to you now and then there's a team that'll go and make the podcast.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. It's the sort of the unsung heroes of... Yeah,
absolutely.
Of, you know...
See, I can't think that. Well, are you feeling funny, team? I'll be really happy to hear that. What you
just said. and you know, there are probably hundreds of people involved in making this book a success, and I'm so grateful to them because they believed the same thing that I did, that it was in somehow kind of important to sort of to bang the junior doctor gong,
it's
and they really got
behind
it. Not a
book you can forget. If you've read that book, you're not going to forget having read that book. It's not going to just be, oh yeah, I read that one day. No, if you've read This Is Going to Hurt, you know you've read This Is Going to Hurt.
Oh, that's nice to hear. That really is. And so I'm hugely proud of what I've done, because I've achieved
the goal I wanted to, which was to spread a message, and I'm grateful to you for
letting me spread it. Thank you so much for coming in. It's been a great pleasure to talk to you.
Thank you.
Are You Feeling Funny is a Snipper Nixon production. The comedy consultant is the legendary Arnold Brown. The series producers are Luke and Alan Nixon, with music from George Montague, audio recorded by Alex Hollingsworth, and the series editor was Luke Nixon. But more importantly, the back-breaking vocal work you are hearing now is done by me, Olivia Nixon. You can find loads more stuff from us to listen to and read at snippernixon.com.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.